The Criterion Collection is rightly famous for its premium DVD and Blu-ray presentations of important and classic films, but Criterion also has a devotion to avant-garde and experimental filmmakers and champions their work with the same deluxe presentation afforded more famous masters of the cinema. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. One of the Criterion Collection's latest releases surveys the work of an artist few film enthusiasts might know, the avant-garde filmmaker Hollis Frampton. To discuss the career of Hollis Frampton and Criterion's release of A Hollis Frampton Odyssey, I'm happy to have back on the program Criterion producer Abby Lustgarten. Thank you, Abby. Good to hear from you.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Last time we were talking about Paul Robeson. That was about 2 years ago, and this is a completely different type of film. One of the things I love about Criterion Collection is this element of discovery that comes with each of your releases, and frankly, I have to plead ignorance that I did not know who Hollis Frampton was before. Now I feel like an expert after going through this. You've worked on this project, I'm sure, for some time. When people ask you what you're doing, how do you describe Hollis Frampton and his work?
Well, I how to describe him? He's a little bit hard to describe because avant-garde film is oftentimes hard to describe. But he is sort of known as a structural filmmaker. He came after the sort of the next generation, after Stan Brakhage and Maya Deren, who were sort of the first round that people began to appreciate.
And grandfathers and of America.
Yeah, the grandfather, grandmother. She was definitely the den mother of all, actually, but Maya Deren. But their films were more about getting into what's in front of the camera, what you're creating through, you know, what you're seeing through the lens, that they're more whimsical, they're more fanciful in a lot of ways. And there was a point where in the 60s, Frampton and other filmmakers, Michael Snow, they began to kind of take a more minimalist approach, and sort of as the same way that art was moving into that direction as well, fine art. And he really took a sort of a more structural approach. I know he said before he hates that sort of pigeonhole category, but it's basically starting with a concept and how to structure the film and then how to create the elements that fit into that structure, you know, and he was quite rigorous about it. He's very mathematically minded, and he loves wordplay and loved, I should say, he passed away in 1984 at the age of 48. But he loved wordplay. He loved referencing literary sources. Big fan of, he was friends with Ezra Pound. He started out as a poet and moved into photography and then picked up a 16-millimeter camera and started making films. His films are sometimes autobiographical in a very sort of loose way, but if you know his history, it's in there. And he was very much a visionary as well. So I think whereas a lot of avant-garde filmmakers kept sort of revisiting similar ideas over and over, Frampton is one of the few that actually could see film being a dead medium in 1974.
It's fascinating. You read the essays that come along with this, and you see the work, and it's almost like he's remaking what's possible with film, and without the baggage of having watched movies. It's almost like he just grabbed a camera and started creating what he thought it should be.
Right, and he definitely came to filmmaking as, I mean, his interests are, he's sort of a polyglot artist, and, you know, he began to incorporate the computer, you know, when computers were just sort of a DOS program.
Right.
His big sort of behemoth project was called Magellan, which was, over time, it grew and grew and grew, and the idea was that it would run 36 hours, but you would watch a portion of it every day for 371 days, actually. It sort of began a few days before the calendar year, and it lasted a few days after. And he, you know, over time, from like 74, I think it was, every film that he made would eventually make its way into Magellan. And it's a project, obviously, he never finished. It's an impossible sort of project, and I think he knew that. But the idea was, I think it sort of came from his interest in programming, for one thing.
Yeah, there's
computer programming.
I guess there were spreadsheets he kept of how he had plotted out all 371 days and what images might be part of those films, and
that's
it was going to be made up of some 800 short films, I think.
Yeah, I mean a whole range. There were about, I think, it was 471 or 741 of these one-minute pans. We have a handful of them in our edition. They're just wonderful. They're, you know, one is a shot of a bead swinging back and forth. Another one is of his stepson who had just caught a frog. The right. frog was just slowly dying and beginning to sort of freak out the child. But, you know, he captures, so these moments are, or it's of cars passing on a bridge. But they're all, because of his photographic background and his interest in graphics, actually, he had a beautiful, sort of elegant and refined sense of framing. So even these one-minute films involve a lot of repetition sometimes, but they're just mesmerizing. And so those would be sprinkled throughout the Magellan cycle. So anyway, so he set himself up with an impossible task, but it was all sort of in the interest of how to take film into another experience for the viewer, not just going to the theater, but
I'm thinking though, if he had lived into the digital age, he might just have completed this project.
I know, right? Or and you know, living into the digital age, he may have found a way to for people to actually access
or expanded it to 360 hours.
Right, and even to access it online, mm-hmm. you know, for anyone around the world to start the Magellan cycle on day one and every day.
Well, you've accumulated here and preserved 24 of his short films, and some are not so short. Some run almost an hour. And you've got them ranked chronologically on the disc, beginning with some early from 66 to 69. There's a lot of short films, that some of which don't even have sound. But you really get a sense of him using a camera and just learning how to physically use it. The equipment, how to edit a piece of film. There's a lot of images of people sitting in chairs, of zooming into hair. I think one of my favorites is a lemon sitting on a table, and the camera doesn't move, but over 7 minutes, the lighting moves very, very slowly around the lemon so that it transforms its texture and color and shape, and it's mesmerizing.
I couldn't have explained it better myself or described it. Lemon was one of the first I had seen. Nostalgia, I think, was the first. But Lemon just, I felt it was so sculptural. It could be, you know, in a museum, and you would just sit and watch it on a loop. And in fact, that's how it was often displayed. What I love about his approach to Lemon was, there's a commentary track that I included, which was really just a piece of an audio interview that I found where he's describing... Actually, he and Robert Gardner are watching the film, and they're talking about it. So I've created a commentary track out of it. And he talks about going to the supermarket to find the star of his film.
So he had to find just the right lemon.
And, you know, Robert Gardner says something like, well, it's very breast-like. And he said, well, you know, the idea of, you know, being able to focus on that has been sort of, you know, prohibited for so long, and I'd like to take it back, you know. So he was well aware of every possible angle people might consider his films when watching them, and he loved that.
But it actually takes something that we see almost daily and makes you focus on it and see it anew.
That's right.
It literally is hypnotizing to watch.
Yes.
Because the lighting changes so subtly and slowly. But you mentioned Nostalgia, which was another one of my favorite films, and my son's, frankly, from 1971. And this is sort of an autobiographical film, I take it, where he's taken 13 photographs, and you just see them sitting on a hot plate one after another and slowly burning while a narrator reads some prepared voiceover narration. And the narration doesn't match the photos that you're watching being burned. They're like one off.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a sense of the beauty of watching this thing be destroyed, but then also the disconnect between the story that's being told and the shifting of it.
That's right. And it requires the viewer to, you know, when you first watch it, you don't know it's sitting on a hot plate.
Right.
You're listening to the voice describing something that is in fact not what you're looking at, but it takes you a while to realize that. And then suddenly, this image that you have been staring at, you know, a spiral coil begins to burn through and it completely incinerates the image. And then you move on to the next one. And now you're hearing what you just, you're hearing described what you just saw in the previous photograph. So you're having to remember that, and yet, again, what am I looking at now? And again, it burns. So the idea of nostalgia and memory, and it really engages the viewer in such a unique way. And again, it's just very sculptural to watch these burning embers of a photograph that are his own, that, you know, they represent a period of his life. He's in one of the photographs. And
right.
So that, too, you're thinking, he's moving. Is he moving on? Is he, you know, is he sort of shedding himself of this period of his life? And, you know,
and a little like the Lemon film, you know, staring at a photograph in a moving picture, where you have the camera just focusing on this photograph and then slowly watching it disintegrate. Now, we don't sit and do that in our own homes, but we've seen things burn.
Yeah.
But just focusing our attention on that process, it's mesmerizing as well. You can't take your eyes off it, and then he lingers on the ash even to watch it continue to curl up.
I'm so glad that you see that in the film, that you have that experience, because I think a lot of people think about avant-garde film as unwatchable, it doesn't make sense, you know, there's no narrative structure here, why, you know,
right.
Lots of questions. And I think what really interested me to pitch this project was the idea of asking our viewers, some of them new to Criterion, others very loyal, to think about film differently, and to think about how you can sort of take objects, take memory, use editing, use sound. I mean, he was wonderful with sound. And create a different experience than you would get from a film with special effects and sound mixing and all
right.
of that. I mean, he was a visionary. And I think it's important to remind people that film can take on many shapes, and none of them are not worth looking at,
right.
you know.
Well, I'm so glad you were an evangelist for that within the company, because it is something that is fascinating about how the Criterion works, is that you clearly put out, the majority of your titles are very important films from world cinema, you know, some of the great directors, Kurosawa, Truffaut, Bergman, Fellini, and such. And then you'll sprinkle in there these sort of tributaries that, because you have such a loyal following, I guess you know that people are going to buy just trusting that they should see this because it's on Criterion.
Well, we hope they will. I mean, you know, I do. I mean, I think Hollis Frampton is, I think it's a stretch for some people, you know.
It will
be. Probably a lot of people. And what saddens me is when they can't see a way into it, you know, when they sort of just can't understand and why it's worth watching the film, because there's such, I find pleasure in Kurosawa, in Bergman, in Godard, in Wes Anderson, and, you know, I think everybody has the ability to open their mind, they just need to take the time. So, yeah, I felt like Hollis Frampton was going to be challenging, we knew he would be, but he's just a unique man to sort of dive into his history.
Well, and you provide a lot of ways to get at that beyond just the actual films. You've got scholarly articles in your booklet that accompanies this. You've got the commentary sometimes with recordings of Hollis Frampton talking about his work. So there's a lot of ways that new viewers like myself can sort of get into it. But I would recommend anyone who gets this to literally spend the night watching it straight through, because one of the things that struck me watching them in a compressed period of time is that while these films evolve and his perspective and concepts change over time, the overriding thing I came across with from all of the films was his use of rhythm. Mm. And maybe that's from his poetry background, but he became what I would consider a fairly expert editor.
Mm-hmm.
And all of his films, whether they're slow or fast or modulated back and forth, have a very specific rhythm to them.
Yes. I think that comes from his interest in, well, again, to use the term, but structural filmmaking. Structural could be random, I suppose, as well, but he was very interested in that experience of every shot being 24 frames long, which is 1 second in film, you know, and having that rhythmic experience. He was very interested in how that would create an overall effect, just as you had. So I think to him, maybe it came from his poetry, maybe it came from a sort of almost like a strict approach. you know, to how he was devising the films. But he loved coming up with mathematical solutions that would override the creation of it.
I think of it kind of as an image poetry, even when there's not a you don't recognize a specific narrative element to it, even though there might be one underneath. The just surface beauty of some of this and the way the images are modulated gives you a visual type of poetry.
Yeah.
Which maybe is what he was going for.
Yeah, I would say so.
I think one of the also the interesting things about these kinds of sets that you do, whether it's this one or Stan Brakhage or even the Jean Panlevé science films from France from the earlier in the century, is that there's all sorts of folks working in film who are coming at it from other perspectives than what we would normally consider as filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while I think we would all agree that film is an art form and the people who practice it are artists, we talk about that all the time. We rarely talk about artists who use film to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a case of someone who, as you mentioned earlier, these films were often presented not in theaters but in art museums. And that's a very different environment.
It is a different environment. It's sort of like he's a painter, but with film. He's,
right.
You know, someone who's a painter takes paint to the canvas again and again and again. And, you know, if they are so obsessed and dedicated to it, it's what they do their whole life. And he was an artist with film, and he used film to expand his own creativity, you know, his own sense of what film can offer. And then obviously getting into computer as well.
Well, hopefully now that more people can experience Hollis Frampton, he'll influence others, and who knows where this will go. But I want to thank you, Abby Lustgarten, for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It's great to be able to express, you know, interest and discuss Hollis Frampton's films. They're terrific.
Well, thanks for your work. My guest today has been Abby Lustgarten, producer of the Criterion Collection's recent release, A Hollis Frampton Odyssey. You can learn more about the work of this film artist by visiting the Criterion Collection's website at criterion.com. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.